Oh my God.
You have a fun little filter thingy in front of your
I
microphone.
do. I do. I can't even turn it. I want to tell you what. I hate this arm. I want to get rid of this arm. And as much as I like this microphone,
Yeah. No,
I
it's funny that you said arm because I was you like lifted your arm. Like,
hate
I hate
this
this arm. And
arm
I'm
in
like, okay, I'm pretty sure she means this arm, but I am unclear.
I want to get rid of my left arm entirely. I'm so tired of her
Know
BS.
what? You're right-handed, you might as well.
It's true.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Blair.
And I'm Kirsten, and we are Mediocre
Mediocre
Content.
Content.
And I hope you're getting a wonderful start to your March. It's wonderful.
Yes, spring is around the corner. The time change is happening soon if you're in the United States.
Oh my God.
The world is getting better. There's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Are we doing the whole not changing the clock backs, by the way? Are we
I
doing
have no
that?
idea.
Somebody
I
set us
feel
out on
like
the
this
calendar.
always comes up, and then people just.
Like, don't
And
forget
then they're
about
like, actually, we're still doing it because we can't get the legislation to pass. And I'm just like, you guys need to get it together.
I feel like
I asked you for one thing.
of all the hills to die on, they're like, no, time change.
Time change.
This is what's really messing with the American people.
Truly. Joe Biden's like, I will get reelected if I do this.
It's one of his campaign notes.
Right. That and trains.
Yeah, trains and oh yes, right, the time
Time
change,
change.
right.
Correct.
All jokes aside though, Blair is 100% right. It's actually started getting staying lighter longer
Yes.
recently. We were on our way back yesterday and it was raining, but even at like 5:15 it was still lighter outside.
Yes.
So I was very pleased.
Same. Yes, it is. It makes my day feel like I don't have to go to bed at 4 p.m.,
Oh my
which is
gosh,
nice.
I know. Or like I'm sitting at work and it's 4 p.m. right now. For anybody that cares, this is how long we've had to procrastinate recording today. But it's 4 p.m. East Coast time and it is so bright outside. It feels like a spring or summer afternoon where after this I'm about to like jaunty over to the polo match and like have a
You
pizza
do
with
live in Rhode Island. Jeez.
my platform sandals and my sun hat.
Oh my God.
I do like my platform sandals though. They're so fun. Have you seen
Which
those?
what kind of platform sandals did you get?
The Steve Maddens. I have a black pair and I have the really glittery silvery pair. Have I
Ooh,
never showed
very
you
nice.
those?
No, we haven't
Oh,
talked in like 2 weeks.
that's fair. But I also wasn't wearing platform sandals last 2 weeks either.
That's fair. Yeah.
I'll send you a picture. They're so cute. And because, I mean, I live the short life.
I know
So,
you
like,
do.
all the sundresses are just like a touch too long, but in those sandals, oh, I feel like a magical woman.
Very nice. We all need a pair of shoes that makes us feel like a magical woman.
We do. Also, the
If
Betsy
Wizard of Oz
Johnsons.
told us taught anything, anyway, what?
The sparkle glitter shoes. Heck yeah. I want to Wendy my way over to a polo match, I guess. I don't know. In
Don't
fairness,
know
hockey
either.
hasn't ended. So we still have a couple of hockey games to go to, but
Hockey is a very long season.
it is a very long season. I think it goes all the way to April. I think we did a whole pod on it, and if you asked me,
We
I
did.
couldn't tell you, but I still enjoy
No.
it. Anyway, I know you have a lot to go over today.
Yes.
So feel free to disclaim if
I
you
shall.
wish.
I shall. So before we get started, obviously we're not experts on anything. You guys know that. If you've been listening to the pod for any length of time, you know that. But we are the place to learn about things that you may or may not have learned about, or things that have may or that may or may not have graced your timeline. So, with that being said, please have fun learning along with us and feel free to comment and 5-star review and all these other things, or 1-star review if you totally disagree with what we say, because that's reasonable of that feedback.
That's very reasonable.
So yeah, Kirsten, tell us some good news.
I will. I will. I'm actually bringing back a little bit of good news from good news that we had so many moons ago. But it's like an updated version of it, I guess.
Okay.
So, do you remember? It's been a very long time. I don't even know what episode it was about, but there was something called Babcock Ranch in Florida that was like that whole town that was like hurricane proof, and they had like the
Oh
whole.
yeah.
Okay,
Yeah.
so this is very similar to that. However, now they're literal homes, like apartment buildings and townhouses, specifically created, and they are in Cortez, Florida, which is like just under Tampa, and it's also about an hour and a half ish north of where the Babcock Ranch is, where all of that kind of took off or whatever.
Oh, cool.
So the little town homes are so special because number one, they're built by a company called Pearl Homes Construction, and they are committed to building homes that can withstand things like Hurricane Ian and Hurricane Idalia. And obviously, one of the bigger issues is losing power, losing the structure of your home. You don't have any resources because now you have no power, etc. And
Sure.
it's really fantastic because these are not only energy efficient homes. They are smart homes that can generate and consume at a rate equal to whatever it's got going on. Don't ask me science terms when it comes to that. The engineering of energy efficiency is wild. But these are also plus 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 rental units, which is also unheard of currently. And if you don't know anything about Florida right now and you're not from the States, every hurricane that has come by over the last however many years has just become aggressively worse, and the infrastructure there is not great. In addition to that, to buy a home there is also to risk not having insurance because a lot of the insurances have pulled out because it's such a high risk. And so you have either homes that you can't really insure without paying thousands of dollars more, or you have apartment homes that aren't really there to withstand the same thing as like a home. So this kind of solves that problem-ish by making it a rental facility, being energy efficient, and also claiming that they are actively showing the world a whole new way to feather a nest, per se. So there's a guy named Marshall Gabuti, currently founder, CEO of Pearl Homes, and they built a huge fashion empire in the 80s and 90s around like women's private label blue jeans, which I didn't really know about. And he
Cool.
decided that he wanted to sell the hedge fund and retire. So now he's building communities with net positive energy homes, i.e., these little Pearl homes, and together they form a virtual power grid, which is crazy in my brain.
Yeah.
So they create modern, affordable communities for people to enjoy and live in, i.e., the rental property, but also develop the communities that are conscious of their total impact environmentally, so they're also environmentally friendly, i.e., the net positive energy home. And they're seen as part of an 86-unit development that they're calling Hunter's Point. So it's just like Babcock Ranch, but that's the name of the community. The development includes 30 already completed and occupied units that were rated as platinum by what's called Leadership in Energy Environmental Design, or LEED. It is a third-party efficiency rating agency and named the first net zero single-family modern housing development on Earth. On Earth. That's insane. Hunter's Point also includes resorts, hotel, the commercial space, and it's right on the ocean front where all of those hurricanes are coming through every year, all the time.
Interesting.
They of course have like two-car garage and whatever else, but the apartment development called the Met offers 1 to 2 bedrooms between 1700 and 2000 in Bradenton, Florida, set within walking distance of entertainment, restaurants, shops, whatever. So it's also really nicely centrally located. And they used construction materials that are good for the environment and human health with recycled content, energy-friendly manufacturing process. It just means that in addition to being really energy efficient, being able to withstand hurricanes, your overall bills are supposed to be like 30% lower because now you're efficiently providing net positive energy. It's made out of recyclable material. Like, Everything that you could think of is finally coming to scale in something that somebody is already physically living in right now. So, this is really fantastic news because it's not just saying that now you can build energy efficient homes. It's to say now you can build something that is sustainable, long term, energy efficient, environmentally conscious. It's like any other urban kind of situation where if you want to be close within walking distance of downtown, you can do that. It just checks all the freaking boxes. So highly amazing news. It's kind of extraordinary, especially given kind of the bad news that they've had in Florida. Like I said, they're dealing with the insurance problem. There's a lot of destruction that still happened and still being dealt with, especially in like even the western side where we used to live, where like Destin and Panama City are. They got hit really hard just this past fall time. And there's like no infrastructure there. So knowing that it can be done, knowing that it can be done affordably, it's really fantastic. And I know some people might balk at the 2000, but I can tell you that the place that we had, and we were in Pensacola at the time, was basically it was 3 bedrooms, 2 full bathrooms, an updated kitchen, an open area, like full, like 9 foot ceiling apartment. Okay, this was like almost 2,000 square feet, and we were paying 1,500 a month. So really, it's not that bad if you have like all the other things going for you.
If you live in California, you will know
Yes.
that that is less than half of what that is more than half of what you're no. What am I trying to say?
What are you
I
trying to
can't.
say?
I'm trying to say that $1,500 is like chump change for anyone who lives in California because rent to rent that size of a place would be is like $4,000.
It's true. And that's to say that honestly, Florida is the only place I've ever seen that. And we've lived in a couple different places. Even the area we live now, you'd be lucky if you find something to rent for under 3 grand and it's going to be like 13, maybe 1200 square foot. So, any hoodle. Long story long, it's great.
Long story long.
Hey, because you know it's never short.
No.
So, also, my second piece of good news still kind of has to do with climate-ish. I would say that's kind of climate because trying to be energy and environmentally conscious. Well, an article came out and the title said Century of Tree Planting Stalls the Warming Effects in the Eastern United States, says study. And I was like, excuse me? So, I just got it. This is what we're doing.
Okay.
A century, I don't know why that was hard for my brain to say a second time. A century,
Right, guys.
century.
She just had a stroke. It's fine.
Yes, don't worry about it. I'll lift up my side real quick. All right. A century of gradual reforestation across the American East and Southeast has kept the region cooler than it otherwise would have become, says this random study. The pioneering study of progress shows how the last 25 years of accelerated reforestation around the world might significantly pay off in the second half of the 21st century. Using a variety of calculative methods and estimations based on satellite and temperature data for weather stations, the authors determined that forests in the U.S., the eastern U.S., cool the land surface by 1.8 to 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit annually, compared to nearby grasslands and croplands, with the strongest effects seen in the summer, of course, when cooling amounts to 3.6 to 9% degrees Fahrenheit. So that's really fantastic. Just randomly for that one region, I guess that's the only place we decided to reforest. I don't know.
That seems about right.
Yeah. The younger the forest, the more this cooling effect was detected. The forest trees between 20 to 40 years old offered the coolest temperatures underneath. I don't know why. That's just something that they pointed out. But Mallory Barnes, who's an environmental scientist at Indiana University and who led the research, she is quoted as saying, "The reforestation has been remarkable, and we have shown this has translated into surrounding air temperature. Moving forward, we need to think about tree planting not just as a way to absorb carbon dioxide, but also the cooling effects in adapting for climate change to help cities be resilient against these very hot temperatures. And that's her quote.
Cool.
Yeah, I guess so. The cooling of the land surface affected the air near ground level as well, with a stepwise reduction in heat linked to the reductions in near surface air temps. And I guess for a little bit of background, they stated that by the 1930s, forest cover loss in the eastern states, such as like Carolinas and Mississippi specifically, had completely stopped as the descendants of European settlers moved in greater and greater numbers into cities and marginal agricultural land was abandoned, of course. The Civilian Conservation Corps undertook large replanting efforts of the forests that had been cleared at the time, and this is believed to be the cause of this lowering temperature. Of course, the author did note that other causes, like more sophisticated crop irrigation and increase in airborne pollutants that block incoming sunlight, may have also contributed to lowering of the temperature over time. So, yeah, it could just be, oh, there's trees here and it's kind of circumstantial. Meanwhile, like the haze above is like, nah, I got you, fam. So it could be either, honestly. But they are seeing they're seeing a bit of a cooling. I don't
In
know.
a plot twist, it could be more pollution.
In a plot twist, we have done this to ourselves. The pollution we've created is now our cover. Isn't it glorious?
Get
Anyway.
ready for eternal winter.
Yeah. Exactly. So, I don't know if that's necessarily good news, but it could be worse
It's
news.
interesting news.
It's interesting news. I'll take it. Anyway, on to public transportation.
Yes, what you all have been waiting for.
I
I
have.
know. So first of all, I just want to give some background on the fact that I love public transportation. I love public transportation so much that I probably should have been a city planner or was a city planner in a previous life. Because I love the idea of living somewhere and not having to worry about having a car, getting to walk out my door and, being able to go to the grocery store and go to, an art museum or like go hang out with my friends without having to drive or pay a ridiculous amount of money for an Uber to get there.
That's fair.
And I think that there are studies that have been shown that having public transportation increases the ability for people to socialize and have a job and, live better quality of lives, which in turn makes their mental health much better. So that is how I feel. And I'm going to educate you guys now on the history
Let's do
of
it.
public transportation in America. I would like
Oh,
to
okay.
preface
Yeah.
that
The
because I can't do it. This is going to be a long podcast already. I can already tell. And if I had to do like history of public transportation of the world, I think I would be here for like 4 hours. And y'all don't want to listen to me talk for 4 hours, okay?
I mean, it would be
So,
very engaging at the very least.
oh, you're so nice. You're so nice.
I mean, we're a good time. Even if it's about public transportation, I feel like we're a good enough time. We could make that 4 hour
We're
something.
at least a good enough time for each other.
That's why
Because
these are
Lord
only like an
knows
hour long.
we've already spent about an hour just talking to each other about nothing. So,
Oh, so fun. And now
and Salem has
Salem has
entered the
joined
chat.
us. It's weird that it's
Don't
not
sit
Jinx
on
this
the
time.
keyboard. Come on, man.
All I can see is his furry butt. I'm so
His
sorry,
butt
listener,
is
that you can't
literally
see it.
up against the camera. Okay. All right. I'm going to need you to move and I need to lift you over the microphone. Come on.
Honestly, there
Come
are
on, come
worse
on, come on.
views. At least I can't see his
Oh.
actual butthole, you know?
All right.
He
All right. Are you good?
is not. The void is very upset.
All right. You can stay right there. All right.
Salem said, "Oh, you have a long podcast? May I extend that time?"
Yeah. If only we were a video podcast, and then they would understand like what we go through.
Oh wait, shameless plug, we do. It's called Twitch, everybody, /
Oh,
mediocre
true.
content podcast.
You're right. You're right. Okay. So let's see. All right. So we're going to start at the early 19th century. And we're going to talk about ferry boats first, because that was really the first form of public transportation that was integrated into American society. So, and the other thing that I want to bring up is that most at this time, and still to this day, like most of the established, like really major cities that we have in the United States, like New York, obviously, but also, you know, Pittsburgh, Charleston, South Carolina, Cincinnati, Ohio, Chicago, are all positioned near a significant body of water, whether that be an ocean, a lake, a river. Well, not so much a lake, mostly rivers, because that's how they were able to get supplies to their city. And a lot of that was through ferry boats, and ferry boats also transported people, because how are people going to be able to get around the city? So before age of industrialization, the cities of the American merchant economy were primarily sites for commercial exchange of goods and services, aka Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and most other major cities at the time. So while geography facilitated the transshipment of goods, it also impeded the expansion of urban settlements. So during the 19 or the during the early 1810s, Robert Fulton, an engineer and inventor, established a regular ferry service using steam power. The service linked Lower Manhattan with Jersey City over the Hudson River, as well as the village of Brooklyn, which I put a sassy
village.
Comment. Ah, yes, the small, quaint village of Brooklyn.
It's just small, very small.
Yeah. At the time, a small suburban settlement across the East River. So Brooklyn has not always been the popular borough of New York City that we know and love today.
If they could see it today.
I know. The early development of regular ferry service illustrates the dominant role that New York City would play in American urban mass transit. Not surprising, considering the city's rapid demographic and physical growth and dominant position in the hierarchy of American cities during the 19th century. As we all learned from Hamilton, New York was going to be the capital of the United States. And then Thomas Jefferson, I don't know.
You.
A bunch of the founding fathers got in a room and was like, nope, we're not going to do this because I want this. So we're going to move it down to DC, which at the time was basically a swamp, but we'll get into that later. So New York has always been like a prominent kind of setting the tone for public transportation in America.
Nice.
All right. So ferries also demonstrate the early connection between transit and urban expansion. So as the service allowed commuters living in areas such as the newly subdivided Brooklyn Heights neighborhood to overcome obstacles for continuous settlement posed by the bodies of water, typically regular users of this service enjoyed above average incomes. So the people who commuted were mostly rich people at this time, because they were the only ones who could afford the fare to go on the ferry boat and take them to their job in Manhattan or whatever.
Oh, that makes sense.
Nowadays, we know that that's not the case. You live as far away from the city as possible, so you don't pay as much on for housing and rent, and then you commute your way in.
Absolutely.
By the 1860s, the annual ridership of the New York's ferry industry had expanded to more than 32 million people. And this is in 1860, not even 1960, 32 million people. 13 companies employed 70 steamboats for more than 20 different ferry routes. Similar service had also spread to other northeastern cities such as Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Cincinnati. Ferry service is still an integral part of daily commuting in some cities today. Despite its success, however, ferry boat service could do little to improve transportation on land, obviously.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're going to get into what I like to call the horse bus.
Okay. Nay.
So by the late 1820s, so ferry boats were 1810s. 1820s is horse bus time. Okay. New York also became home to the first significant form of land-based mass transit, which is the omnibus, which is basically a large horse-drawn wheeled carriage, similar to a stagecoach, but it's more for the general public as opposed to just 2 to 4 people. And it's literally like a bus, just because they didn't have cars, so they didn't have the bus, so they did the
right.
horse thing.
Right,
right.
Right.
Okay.
They
All
did
right.
The horse
All right.
Thing. Oh my God.
Originated in France in 1826, omnibus service spread to Paris 2 years later, and to other French cities as well, as well as London by 1832. Abraham Brouwer brought the service to New York in 1828 when he launched a route running 1.25 miles long, quarter along Broadway. Brouwer's original vehicles, accommodation and sociable, held approximately 12 passengers. I guess they named the vehicles, which is kind of cute.
They named them accommodation
and sociable.
Interesting.
3 years after Brouwer inaugurated service, more than 100 omnibuses traveled on New York streets. By the 1840s, Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and other American cities had omnibus service, and it spread from larger to smaller cities in subsequent decades. So there were weaknesses with this particular mode of transportation. First of all, the seats were unpadded, and the streets were not paved like we know and love today. They were very bumpy.
Ouch.
Because they had cobblestone slash maybe dirt.
Lovely.
So that was very uncomfortable. And the fare was 12 cents, which was also incredibly high.
I wonder what
for
that
this
was
time period.
In like today's money.
That's a great question. I would love to tell you. Shall we do a live
oh, sure.
calculation here?
Yes. You
right.
You go ahead and I can do it.
Inflation calculator.
Inflation calculator.
Because I can't do math.
Bro, I can't do math either.
All right. So it is. So let's see. What did I say? That was like 18 something.
1820.
Oh, this only goes to 1913. That's stupid.
Oh, no.
Can I type it in? No.
Wait, I
okay,
think I found one from 1635.
Okay, you do it. You do it.
Okay, hold on. So it was, what was it? 1820.
So,
right.
1820, 12 cents.
12 cents would have been, oh, it's only $3.16.
Well, it was a lot of money for them at the time.
I guess so. I guess $3 doesn't even get you a Big Mac these days.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
Not that they had Big Macs then either. I'm just stating.
Okay, so it was 12 cents, which was too expensive for most urban dwellers. So, and again, the people who lived in the city were generally much more poor than the people who lived in the suburban areas.
Yeah.
So, nonetheless, the omnibus initiated a riding habit of regular transit use within its main segment of users, so members of the urban middle class. This growing demographic found private stagecoaches too expensive, but they had the affluence and desire to commute to work instead of walking, although getting around by foot remained the main source of mobility for most urban dwellers. The walking city was slowly eroding. Okay. So initially, like, especially in Europe, you have these small cities outside of like Paris and London, like the big ones, right? So you have these small cities and you are able to get from the grocery store to the cobbler or whatever, you know, like think about like Beauty and the Beast and her little village. Like
Right.
she's able to walk around and do all her chores,
Yeah.
right? But now that we are able to have our lovely horse-drawn carriages that
Right.
have a lot of people, our horse buses, if you will, it is unlikely that people are going to be walking around, and
Yeah.
therefore businesses will be like, all right, well, we can go outside of this little 2 mile radius and people will still be able to come and see us. And therefore, the walking city is starting to decay, which is very
Yeah.
upsetting to me as a person. I prefer to live, I would love to live in the fantasy world that the Gilmore girls live in because they can walk from their house to
True.
get breakfast at Luke's Diner. Then you can go and get groceries and then to the movie store and then to the ice cream place. And I'm just like, this is perfect. Why don't we have this? Anyway, maybe it's just a fantasy. I don't know.
I mean, it was a reality for some people at some point.
Okay, so now a vehicle with less surface friction could reduce the shortcomings that had plagued the omnibus. Horse streetcars, so horse cars, if you will,
Vroom, vroom.
commonly known as horse cars, traveled on a rail instead of a road. This had numerous advantages over the omnibus. First and foremost, it was faster and quieter.
There.
So, comfortable ride, and while enabling a more efficient use of horsepower, which I would venture to guess, this
Yeah.
is where we get the term horsepower for
One would
cars.
say,
I
one would
would, you
think.
know, just putting two and two together, one plus one
I
makes two. You know what I mean?
mean, unless you're a freaking omnibus and then it's like four.
Well, yes. So, this fact allowed for larger cars that carried approximately three times as many riders as the omnibus. Importantly, the horse car's lower operating cost per passenger mile translated into cheaper fares. So, this was 5 cents as compared to 12 cents.
Okay. Hold on. Hold on. Here we go. Hold on. One moment. One moment. It was only $1.32.
Which is,
So
I think, way more reasonable.
I would think so, you know?
Yeah. So, this grew a population of consistent riders in the city, right? So horse cars reduced the time and cost of commuting to and from the central core of the city, and they expanded the area of development along the urban, allowing a sl following a slow start. Other American cities adopted horse cars by the 1850s, part of the wider context of rampant urbanization during the second half of the 19th century. Typically, a private company ran lines under a franchise awarded by the municipality that outlined the public roads on which the company could build rails and operate routes along with other stipulations. At the end of the 1850s, New York, New Orleans, Brooklyn, Boston, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Cincinnati provided horse car service.
Wow.
So, expansion developed in the 1860s. 2 decades later, almost 20,000 horse cars traveled on more than 30,000 miles of street railway across the
Jeez.
United States. I know.
That's a lot.
Expansion was particularly notable in contrast with the comparatively slower growth in Europe. And horse cars' initial development in the United States and its early spread across the country exemplified how the country was often at the forefront of transit use and technological innovation through the second half of the 19th century and the early 20th century. So, horse car lines developed differently in each city based on a variety of different things, as you can imagine, politics, geography, population density, etc. And it was kind of revolutionary in the way that it transported people. It was very efficient, etc., etc. The street, so up until this point, which I thought was kind of interesting. Up until this point, people were just out and about in the street, There were no
Right.
need for sidewalks because there was nothing dangerous on the street for people
Right.
to get run over by.
Oh,
Horse
right.
cars.
Oh, God.
Horse cars.
I didn't even think about that.
So now we're shifting to the point where streets were more of a place for mobility, diminishing the centrality of the sociable and recreational and other traditional street uses.
Yeah.
And at this point, I would imagine moms would be like telling their kids, get out of the street, for the first time in recorded history.
For real.
Initially, popular sentiment opposed and of the placement of rails along the street because they were not flush with the street surface. So you just basically had like elevated rails,
Oof.
and it made it really hard for people to walk across the street because you could like trip.
Well, yeah. Well, also, if you're like, if you own a business and you're trying to like cart your stuff,
Right.
from place to place, how are you going to do that with a giant track in the middle of the
Right.
street?
Right. No,
Yeah.
exactly. So that and eventually they did get the grooved like embedded in the road
Yeah.
rails, and that happened in 1852. Side note, the urbanization of the horse car led to the growing exploitation of horsepower. Ironically, steam power, an essential component of the Industrial Revolution, created a greater demand for this older form of energy in industrial cities.
Wow.
So the horse car's reliance on these like living machines presented the greatest weakness of the technology because they wanted to expand the systems, but horses are expensive, first
Yep.
of all,
Yep, you gotta
as
maintenance
any
them.
horse girl will tell you.
So true.
So expensive, there's a lot of maintenance that goes into horses. There's they have to be fed,
They get old.
and then not to mention they're like pooping all over the street, which is like a whole other issue.
Delicious.
And then you have to pay like the people who take care of them, like veterinarians, stable hands, blacksmiths, the whole nine for the horseshoes, right? And then they get old and they die.
Yep, that's what, yep, that would be, yep.
Yeah. And then machines don't die necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, they decay
Sometimes the
significantly
parts get
faster.
old, but you can like replace them, right? But like, they don't. It's not the same. It's not the same
It's
thing.
not this. Well, it's like dealing with a horse carcass as opposed to like a car
Correct.
carcass.
New York alone disposed of 15,000 horse carcasses
Whew.
a annually.
Annually.
Annually. Every
Oh.
year.
Whew.
And then sudden disease outbreaks were common. So I guess
Right.
in 1872, the equine influenza epidemic
Ooh.
hit North America, especially the
Yeah.
eastern seaboard cities, so like New York, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And it created a operational upheaval for the horse car industry. And now with that was kind of the finally the last straw. They were like, all right,
Yeah.
we need to figure something else out because it's not working.
It's usually disasters like that that just kind of humble your thoughts.
You would think, yeah. So, now we'll move on to steam rail. So steam was one alternative source of power. We have got to the point in history where we've discovered the steam engine for the railways, which we talked about in previous episodes, I think a little bit with like theme parks and that kind of thing. So it provided power for ferry services since the 1810s and passenger railways for 2 decades later. By the mid-19th century, commuter railways using steam locomotives connected affluent residents living in small suburban areas to places of work and entertainment in large cities, also amusement parks. So many city dwellers living along crowded streets considered the noise pollution and other dangers associated with the technology to be nuisances. Nuances. I almost said nuances, and I was like, that's not right.
Nuances. What was the one? Century.
A century. So steam operation also generally cost more than horsepower until the 1870s, and that's when companies gambled on steam power during the 1860s, but they all soon like ceased their experiments. So this proved to be among the earliest forms of rapid transport, since vehicles operated on their own right of way, not in mixed traffic. And by 1893, Jay Gould's New York Elevated Rail Company carried 500,000 daily passengers from Lower Manhattan to the Bronx, while Chicago saw the first of its L system in 1892. So steam rail was integrated into the cities, but not well liked because of the noisy traffic, basically.
Yeah,
And like
that's fair.
they already had like some of the rail systems with the horse cars, but they decided for some cities to like elevate them, and so they would go through the buildings and not be on the street. There's a famous one in New York called the High Line, which has been since converted to a park.
Cute.
But you can go and walk along the railroad, and there's, beautiful plants and art installations and stuff. And I just did a mini deep dive on that because I thought it was really interesting to find out like the history. So in the mid-1800s, freight trains on street level tracks run by New York Central Railroad delivered food to Lower Manhattan, but created dangerous conditions for pedestrians. 10th Avenue became known as Death Avenue, and by
Whoa.
1910, more than 540 people had been killed by trains.
Oh my God.
Yes.
You just like walk out. Why are people walking out in front of
So in the 1920s, in response to the mounting deaths,
trains?
because they had no idea, they didn't know that the train was coming, I guess, other than and before it was too late. I don't
Oh.
know. Because they were going so fast.
I guess. Yeah,
In
well.
response to mounting deaths, the railroad hired men on horses to protect pedestrians until their final ride in 1941. The West Side Cowboys patrolled 10th Avenue waving red flags to warn of oncoming trains. And you know what I thought of when they said waving red flags? Have you seen the red flag guy on TikTok?
That's so funny.
That's who I
Danger.
think of.
They were the pre-crossing signs.
Yes, 1,000%. 1924, the West Side Improvement Project first began when the city's Transit Commission ordered the removal of street level crossings. This later led to a plan to remove tracks from the streets and create an elevated rail line, hence the High Line. And in 1933, the first train on the High Line, which was then called the West Side Elevated Line, was fully operational and transporting millions of tons of meat, dairy, and produce.
Nice. Fixed it.
Yeah, the lines cut directly through
It's
some buildings, creating easy access for factories like the National Biscuit Company, aka Nabisco, which was now the home of the Chelsea Market.
You know what's
So,
cool? I think there's
yeah.
one in China as well. Is it China where like the rail car goes through like a hotel or like an apartment building or something like that? Like it's
Yeah.
crazy. That's what I imagine this
So
is.
it doesn't go through like the actual building, but it weaves in and out of like high rises. So it doesn't, it's like elevated off the road, but it like goes like through the buildings.
Apparently this one goes through the physical building,
Yeah,
which would be
no. That's not
whoa.
what this is. No.
I was like, wow, is
They were
it
advanced at the time, but they weren't that advanced.
Jeez.
Yeah. So anyway, that's your that is your steam rail deep dive. You're
Very
welcome.
fun.
All right. So now we're getting into cable cars and streetcars. If you've been to San Francisco or have watched an episode of Full House, you know what this is. Power generated from a stationary central source rather than within a moving locomotive offered another alternative, which are our cable cars. So I take that back. Cable cars are different than street cars. Cable cars are traveling on rail, which fine, similar to horse cars and steam railways, but these vehicles are clasped onto a moving cable within a street conduit. So it's like the manual version of the electric streetcar, which is what I was talking about earlier. Okay, so this feature eliminated much of the noise, smoke, danger, and danger of broiler explosions
Yeah, it's just very simple.
that plagued the urban steam locomotives.
What a simple problem.
Although such nuisances were still present at the stationary power source, cable car operation began in San Francisco in 1873 when Andrew Hallady began his service on Clay Street. San Francisco's hilly terrain required four horse teams to pull, it's true, pull a single omnibus, with some hills too steep for any kind of horse service. Which totally makes sense because there are some steep hills.
I think of Princess Diaries.
Oh, 1,000%. It's terrifying. I would never want to learn to drive in San Francisco.
Not a
Oh,
stick,
God.
that's for sure.
No,
Woo.
no. So since various transit experiments in steam, compressed air, chemical engines, and electricity failed to produce an inexpensive method of propulsion, cable cars seemed like the best alternative to horsepower by the 1870s. Following Hadley's successful operation, most large cities across the United States built cable car networks. With hindsight, the cable car emerged as a temporary solution for the transit industry until the refinement of a more efficient power distribution method. Cables had advantages over horsepower, but they also carried particular weaknesses. The cables were always under threat of snapping, which is definitely a problem. Maintenance and replacement constituted a complex, expensive process that negatively affected the service. Ice buildup produced issues in colder cities,
Fair.
and the cable had to run at the same capacity no matter the service level, which meant power generation could not diminish at off-peak times. 20 years after Hadley's first run on Clay Street, more than 300 miles of cable car tracks had been laid across the United States, but numbers declined soon after the electric streetcar operation became practical in ni 1890. So at the turn of the we have only 20 miles of cable car left. Cable car track was left in by 1913. And then electric streetcars took over. Which
Nice.
totally makes sense. Technological innovations demand from the transit industry for improved operations, and a desire for mobility enabled the electric streetcar to become the most or the dominant mass transit vehicle in the United States at the turn of the 20th century. The streetcar's use of electricity made it a key technology of the second industrial revolution. This was a big deal. So the railway companies quickly adopted this, or the street railway companies, I should say. Often they used existing rails and even former horse car vehicles. So there was some recyclability to this, which is kind of cool. New forms of expertise related to electricity replaced veterinarians, blacksmiths, and other horse-related professions, which is mildly sad.
I
But you
mean,
know.
but at the same time, you don't have the magnitude of horse deaths nor horse
Correct.
poo to contend with.
Exactly.
Can you imagine how smelly that was for like a really
Oh
long
my
time?
gosh. Well, and then we'll talk about this later, but there was a whole thing. We'll talk about it later. We'll come back to this. Just remember how smelly that might have been. So transit remained within the private market in most American cities until the second half of the 20th century, but the organizational structure of the industry became more complex. So, electric streetcars rapidly spread across the country like horse cars decades earlier. Electric streetcars accommodated heavier passenger loads compared to its predecessors. This reduced passenger costs per mile, lowered fares, and stimulated greater transit used by wider segments of society. Okay. All
Nice.
right. Almost there. And then we'll give you guys a break.
Having a blast. I'm learning about horse poo,
I'm
so
so glad. Yeah. All right. So electric traction also removed an obstacle for underground transit. So here's the beginnings of the subway systems in
So
multiple
fun.
areas. So the London Underground had operated steam-powered trains when it opened in 1863, but most commentators believed Americans would avoid smoke-filled subway tunnels. So just to clarify, and I
Wait,
did look
what?
this up, I just to clarify, the London Underground, the tube, if you will, they were putting full-blown locomotives in tunnels underground with no regard to air quality. They used gaslit wooden carriages and steam locomotives.
Now, suddenly that boiler explosion concern is coming up.
That's all I'm saying.
Just a light issue turned into a very grave one. Oh, no, she's frozen. We were doing so good. Future Kirsten, this is where you're gonna need to cut. There you are.
Hi, hello. What
Oh,
did I cut off?
that's weird. All I said was, this is where that boiler room explosion's coming up, and then you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Something like
Yeah.
that.
So that's it. I don't understand.
Yeah, first of all, how could you see anything?
Right.
Also,
Right.
that's insane.
Also, Londoners really be out here like, yep, this is seems like a good idea.
YOLO in the olden days, I guess.
They're like, we've already been through it. We've seen what World War II and World War I are. We're like,
Fine.
we're done.
It's
We're good.
chill.
Actually, this was before that, but still,
There,
still.
yeah, it's fine. I don't know history.
I don't know. It all happened somewhere
It
along the
did.
line. All right. So, the massive construction cost also impeded subway building. In
Fair.
1894, the Massachusetts legislature authorized Boston to build the first subway in the United States. So it was not the New York subway, which is what I previously had thought.
Yeah.
The line, which was completed in 4 years later, buried 1.5 miles of a busy streetcar under Tremont Street retail district. The Boston Transit Commission, a public body, financed the construction, while the private West End Street Railway operated the line and serviced its debt. Public money was also required to build the country's largest subway network in New York, foreshadowing the growing role of the state in mass transit in the second half of the 20th century. In 1904, the Interborough Rapid Transit Company's service began connecting the Bronx to Manhattan, followed by the construction of hundreds of more miles of subway in New York during the subsequent decades.
Nice.
And it hasn't been updated since.
Right, exactly.
Streetcars played a dramatic role in suburbanization. So that was kind of your little like subway
Yeah.
moment. We're not gonna fully get there because it doesn't catch on the same way that the streetcars did because of the
Yeah.
introduction of the regular car, which we'll get to.
And also, do you go over like the metros as well?
So yes, we'll touch on that.
Okay.
It's more of like, so it's the more environmentally friendly version of the subway,
Yeah, and
which we'll
usually
get
above
to.
ground most of the time in some
Yeah.
cases. Yeah.
Yeah. So streetcars play a dramatic role in suburbanization. Unlike the natural limits of horse cars, electric streetcars could journey blah blah blah. We know this already. But the big point here is that, it's still all of this public transportation is allowing cities to expand and the suburban areas are getting bigger and bigger, right? Let's see. So accessible cheap land enabled suburban residential developments of semi-detached or detached dwellings set back from the street and surrounded by a yard. Apartments also existed. So all of these streetcars and public transportations were allowing people to have yards and like live the American dream, quote unquote, because they had access to transportation to get into the city where everyone was working. Walkability remained important for at least some daily tasks, and of course, for the journey to the nearby streetcar stop. Streetcar suburbs had fairly compact forms and high population densities compared to the automobile-centric suburbs that developed in the later 20th century. Although such forms and densities varied based on local influences, levels of affluence, and other factors, as we have seen. Real estate speculators knew the value of the streetcar service to their developments. In many cases, transit companies held real estate interests along the urban fringe, which they connected via streetcar to spur development. Even if the line itself was unprofitable, yet the many streetcar suburbs that still dot the American landscape today were not simply the result of ambitious developers, but also the desires and actions of many people, from local politicians to varied residents who made such places home. So, yeah, public
Nice.
transportation has the ability to form communities.
Yeah.
Okay. Last tidbit here. So the demand, let's see. Transit also enabled new social experiences associated with the modern age, as we know. Streetcars linked people to department stores, theaters, and other attractions of downtown. And in the second half, we'll talk about the decline of mass transport or mass transportation, and we will talk about the introduction of the car, which is
Yay.
lovely. And there was something else that I was gonna add in.
Was it
Think about
buses?
we did buses are in the second half, I think.
Fun. I do love a good bus. You know, the only buses
Yeah.
that I really liked, honestly, wasn't even public transportation. It was literally just field trips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll talk. I hope I didn't bore you guys too much.
No. I think it's
But
cool.
yeah. Oh, this is what I was gonna tell you. Sorry, last thing, I swear. So you remember how you said the horses were all stinky, right? And they had like stuff. So in the 19th century, belief in the miasmic theory of disease, which basically meant that like vapors imitating or emanating from like rotting things like fruits and stuff would like cause disease, kind of helped the electric streetcars gain popularity because of all the poop that was in the streets,
That's fair.
which they weren't necessarily wrong about, but also
Right.
like that's not exactly right.
It's not, you know, they were close. They
They were
were
close.
so close. Closer
Yeah.
than they should have been to poo.
So that was one of the things that like really helped
Yeah.
electric streetcars like gain popularity in addition to like the low fares and like the efficiency and all that stuff. So
I mean, if you don't know what it's like living next to like a poo plant in the States, like, can you imagine just living in a poo plant? 'Cause that's
yeah.
probably what it was like.
Yeah.
Oof. Good
Not
grief.
great.
There's one Just a little side tangent. There's one where I would drive to Buena Vista when we were in Lynchburg, because that's where one of the ballet studios was. And I would drive through it, and you always knew you were getting close because you would smell the poo plant before you saw the poo plant. And it was always right there, ripe and ready. And I always thought, I wonder if the people that live here smell. I wonder if the people that live here go out outside of the poo plant city. I wonder if they, first of all, still smell poo or if they smell like poo.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's worth it for like a cheaper house. I don't know.
It was intense. That's all I
Yeah.
can say. Well, anyway.
All right. Well, we'll see you guys in the second half.
Every week, you listen to the MCP host droll on and on about, quote, interesting topics. And yes, I did just use air quotes for that.
We are positive your listeners would come up with better topics than them. And so we are enlisting you to send them over so we can talk more about exciting things in the future episodes.
We highly encourage you to do yourself and other listeners a favor and start sending good topic ideas over to mediocrecontentpodcast@gmail.com.
We even give you permission to slide into their DMs over on Instagram at mediocrecontentpodcast and Twitter at mediocresquawks.
If you don't decide to send topics over, prepare yourself for continued intense mediocrity.
Though honestly, it will probably be mediocre either way. Thanks for trying, and good luck in the second half of this interesting podcast, air quotes still included.
Stop playing around, Chris. We're trying to record.
Yeah, Chris.
Yeah, Chris.
Playing around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hope everybody had a nice little break. What?
That was funny.
Let's see. So we're going to talk about the decline of mass transit in the 20th century.
I feel like for some reason it feels like you're like, yeah, these are all the wonderful things. And it's gone back so far. And we have so many places to go. And then it's just like, and then it went down.
Yeah. So this is what happened. Let me tell you how the car lobby screwed up our country. Here we go. All right. In my humble opinion, mass transit was very important in the lives of city dwellers, and it decreased by the 1920s. And it declined steadily. So people continued to not use public transportation as much until around the 1970s. And in many ways, this has continued on to the present. The roots of this trend emerged during the early 20th century. From 1890 to 1905, annual streetcar ridership across the country more than doubled from 2 to 5 billion passengers. Okay. However, over the next two decades, ridership grew at a slower rate. From 1917 to 1923, the industry added only 1 billion more annual trips. Okay. Annual transit ridership, all modes, including subway, streetcar, and bus, peaked in 1926, including. When this excludes like war related conditions, so like the 1940s, right? Because there was a lot happening.
Fair.
Really?
Salem?
Really?
Bruh.
So peaked in 1926 with more than 17 billion passenger trips, a figure that has been unmatched since then. Okay. The slowdown in transit ridership growth coincided with an explosion of automobile ownership and use. And in 1910, Americans owned less than 500,000 automobiles, a figure that rose to 8 million vehicles 10 years later in 1920. 46 mass transit's fall in prominence is more. All right, never mind. Just kidding. I don't know why I said 46. That was just the editor note. Anyway, mass transit's fall in prominence is more complicated than simply the invention and popularity of the private automobile. Fine. But it's a big factor. Okay.
It is a big, because people would just go themselves instead of paying somebody else to do it for them.
Right. So as the historians of technology remind us, no technology is innately superior to another. Rather, social values and practices influence the acceptance of technologies based on complex factors, which is fine, but I really feel like this is, I feel like cars and the lobbyists that come with cars are just a little bit unhinged.
I mean, true. And I think and this is just my opinion as well, but the other factor is like the average person is like, when you pay your taxes, okay, your taxes probably go to some like infrastructure for like public transport, but it's not like you're paying monthly payments on something forever that they've locked you in financially for. So like, it's definitely easier to just get around the way you want to get around if you don't have to rely on public transportation, you just have your own car. But the counter to that is now you have like a loan for the rest of your life, basically.
Yeah. So yeah. And yeah. Speaking of like financials,
yeah.
Starting in the 1910s, inflation imposed pressure on the overwhelmingly private-owned transit industry, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So transit companies began to reduce investment in their capital stock before World War I. Yeah. Inflation led to increased prices for materials. The value of street rails rose by 50% after the war. Mm-hmm. Labor, the largest part of the industry's operating routes, also became more expensive as the workers unionized. Greater demand for better service from interest groups, not only users who protested against any hike to the common 5-cent fare, but also politicians and business groups, compounded these economic forces by making more difficult and the implementation of positive reforms that could have improved and the competitiveness of transport against the automobile. So
yeah,
ultimately it just became too expensive for public transportation
yeah.
to compete with the automotive industry. Yeah. The other thing that developed out of this automobile boom, if you will, is the jitneys, which are privately owned automobiles operated by entrepreneurs who cruised streets, typically those with transit routes, in search of possible customers.
Right.
So on a small scale, it would be like taxis, I guess.
Right.
So passengers enjoyed the jitney's flexibility, especially its ability to drop off riders closer to their destination compared to the same cost as a streetcar. Mm-hmm. Unlike transit companies, jitneys were usually unlicensed and had no municipal fees or taxes. Transit operators saw jitneys as unfair competition and pressured local governments to prohibit the service in many cities. The jitney enjoyed only short-lived success, but it provided one example of how the automobile threatened the transit industry. And I imagine it's probably the first version of what we know now is taxis and Ubers and all that stuff.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Their perception that transit was a private business rather than a public service deserving government aid added to the industry's woes. So at this point, it was all like private companies doing this public service. And so now as a country, we're kind of like, well, the government needs to step in because this is affecting a lot of people, and the government's like, hold on now, we did not budget it for this.
Wait a minute.
This has been working out fine.
Yeah.
So I don't understand what your problem is. Right. Yeah.
Right. Like, especially in those big cities.
Right. And if nobody's riding anymore, you have no revenue.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. And then, I mean, also because of that decline and because of the lack of aid in it, you're also talking about how your good news was recently just trying to connect end to end with a train.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. For people Absolutely. Transport, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So historian Ball Barrett argues that municipal ordinances passed in Chicago in 1907 enforced levels of service on the city's private transit provider, but they failed to provide subsidy that would make such a service financially feasible. Instead, either complete municipal ownership or minimal regulation constituted a better alternative. San Francisco had municipalized transit in 1912, the progressive city that it is, but few cities followed suit until the 1950s. Transit was not alone in suffering from negative opinion, but the automobile did too, despite its relative newness. Historian Peter Norton has shown that the consensus of politicians, city planners, and most citizens believed automobile use on city streets should be highly regulated to ensure not only the safety of other road users, especially pedestrians, but also the efficient flow of traffic. Mm-hmm. This is very important. The young automobile industry countered such settlement by branding its product as the symbol of individual freedom. It also lobbied policymakers. So the strategy allowed motordom, quote unquote, to gain policy concessions for items such as parking restrictions, often at the expense of the transit industry and other street users. The private nature of the automobile also may have influenced transit users to drive cars, especially women. Basically, the companies creating cars at the time were basically saying, our car provides you individual freedom. Mm-hmm. It keeps women safe because they don't have to be out on the streetcar late at night. Mm-hmm. And it's better to be in your own car than to be in a crowded streetcar with all these other people who mm-hmm. smoke cigarettes and harass you.
The common man problems.
Right. And then we enter the bus era.
Salem is once again joined.
And it's kind of weird about the bus, because you would think that the bus and streetcar provide like basically the same service. Right.
Yeah.
However, as the story goes, scholars and other analysis offered varied explanations for the replacement of streetcars by buses across the United States. One interpretation claims that the phenomenon emerged as part of a conspiracy by General Motors. So this argument became popular in the early 1970s when lawyer Bradford Snell testified in front of the U.S. Senate subcommittee. He contended that General Motors, under its National Coach Line subsidiary, purchased a number of transit companies during the 1930s and 40s in order to convert streetcar lines to bus operation, with the purpose of weakening or eliminating transit service so that the disgruntled passengers would purchase automobiles.
Oh.
So they literally bought streetcars mm-hmm. to make them buses. Mm-hmm. To make the buses terrible, to then get people to buy cars.
Buses are terrible in some cases.
The theory entered popular culture as inspiration for a plot line in the 1988 film Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Ah, great movie.
Although the investigation ultimately found that GM broke antitrust laws, mm-hmm. typical, the central conspiratorial charge, the provision of poor transit service in order to increase automobile sales, was not the basis of the investigation. In fact, most transit historians and other scholars generally disregard the conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
National coach lines controlled approximately 10% of the country's urban transit systems, yet a majority of the remaining 90% of the companies also switched to buses. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Moreover, a consensus within the transit industry believed that buses operating without the capital concerns of rails possessed economic and operational benefits compared to streetcars, especially on lower density systems. So basically smaller cities.
Yeah.
The case of bus substitution in New York City, so when they were in the 1920s and 30s, mm-hmm. Suggests that politics played more of a role than like cost benefit situation. So
and this is like the city buses, though. This isn't like, like what are they? Like the Greyhounds private... or anything.
Yeah. Okay. No, so Greyhounds count
they
as
count?
Like public
okay.
transportation. Yeah.
All mm-hmm. right.
Well, no, that's, you're right. City buses, Greyhound is its own private thing. You're right.
Yeah. Okay. So this is just like getting from place to place within the city on a bus as opposed
right,
to,
which
like,
is what streetcars would have been doing.
Right. Right.
But then somebody decided to make the decision that buses were better, even though, according to this, it wasn't necessarily the best situation for New York specifically, cost-wise.
Yeah, that makes sense. Also, the streets in a big city like that aren't huge. Like, the buses are massive. So,
true. Yeah. True.
Although, now, have you seen the accordion things? Like, the accordion buses? They do have those now, technically. I guess maybe, I don't know if they have those in New York, but
I've rode those in Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay.
They're kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of fun. It's, I mean, it
there's
makes
like a
sense.
Seat in the middle with the accordion part, and it's very fun.
I mean, if you're thinking about having to make those really sharp turns in a city, that makes sense.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
So now we know that the car lobby is out to get us. After World War II, the longer trajectory of declining passenger numbers resumed, which numerous transit companies faced financial ruin, which led to the public ownership of the, so the government basically running the public transportation in Chicago, Los Angeles, and other cities, which Los Angeles has terrible public transportation. Not like, like Los Angeles, get it together. Like, come talk to me.
If personal. You,
like, I get it together. Which in, also, Los Angeles was designed as a, like, car-specific city.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, nobody had public transportation in mind for Los Angeles. They were like, this is going to be glamorous and for all the rich people from New York, and we're going to only drive our cars here, which is why LA traffic is so bad. Anyway.
I have heard horror stories, yes.
Yeah. So despite the wave of public takeovers during the 1940s and 50s, the popular conception of transit as a service run on cost recovery basis remained unchanged. So service failed to improve significantly enough to curtail declining ridership. And at the same time, the post-war years marked the growth of the automobile-dependent suburbs. The American dream became very popular in society. So you would have your car, your house, your yard, your kid, your dog, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the post-war, or let's see, in 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower signed the Federal Aid Highway Act, which dedicated $25 billion in 1956 to build more than 40,000 miles of limited access roadways across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Although transit decline began decades before the federal government constructed new highways, the interstate program, which funded 90% of urban expressway costs, demonstrated the federal government's enthusiasm for automobility.
I mean, again, I would just like to say it's probably because they can keep you loaned up for a really long time.
Yup. By the 1950s, the United States had become a car country, according to which I think is some sort of guy who knows what he's talking about this stuff.
Probably.
Anyway. Meanwhile, the transit industry suffered, but change was around the corner, sort of. So,
like the tagline, kind of, a little bit.
Mass transit made a modest comeback in the 1960s when the in 1964, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Urban Mass Transportation Act. The legislation enabled capital grants for the federal government to cover a maximum of 2/3 of the capital costs of equipment and facilities for transit systems. Over the next decade, Washington provided more than $3 billion, which cities used to purchase private systems, improve existing vehicles and infrastructure, and build new systems. From 1960 to 1974, the number of publicly owned transit systems rose from less than 60 to more than 300, yet federal funding alone did not solve the woes. Ridership continued to be terrible. And more dramatically, some of the cities use the funding to, or actually, some of the cities use the funding to conduct a rapid transit system. And this is where we talk about the metro.
The metro.
So
yeah.
Another major system developed in the nation's capital, the Washington Metro, originated from ideas within planning circles during the 1950s, small rapid transit system in conjunction with the larger network of automotive freeways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So inner city residents feared the damage that the controversial Three Sisters Bridge over the Potomac River, as well as other freeways plans, would have on their communities and local environment. They pushed for a larger rapid transit system as an alternative to the expressway web, but that didn't work because, as we know, it's mm-hmm. all there. The eventual 100-mile metro system faced challenges, including a period of stalled capital funding from expressway proponents before the congressional vote stopped the logjam. The first leg of the system opened in 1970. With subsequent sections open during the next three decades. Nice. So in the 1970s as well, public transportation became more popular because we were becoming more aware of our environment. Mm-hmm. And we realized that all of the cars that we are driving don't produce carbon dioxide, which is depleting the ozone layer.
It's just a small thing.
Just like a small thing. So they... You know, people became more aware of the negative consequences of urban freeways, energy crises, and general like disillusionment with the dominant car culture, which I think is what we're still kind of experiencing now, is a lot of people feel like there's too many cars in the road. It's too dangerous. It's too expensive. You know, it's just like a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas public transportation can be so much more convenient, I feel. So anyway, those things led to a small uptick in public transportation participation.
Nice.
Since the 1980s, numerous cities have built light rail transit, and then, which is abbreviated LRT. With LRT, vehicles operate on lines with dedicated rights of way, but power is supplied by overhead wires instead of a third rail.
Hmm.
Light rail requires lower capital costs and ridership levels compared to heavy rail systems. The LRT projects have become more common than capital intensive heavy rapid transit systems such as BART, which is the one they have in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And the Washington Metro. So escalating construction costs and more restrictive environment of federal funding for capital projects is one motivation for LRT's rise. And that began in the 1980s, like I said, and actually in Norfolk, Virginia, where mm-hmm. we used to live, mm-hmm. they did do a light rail. And there is some ridership, but it's not great because, yeah. you know, we already have the infrastructure for all the parking.
Yeah.
So now, in order to build new public transportation, it really, like, the car situation has to get to a point where it's just, like, extremely unbearable, and people have to start, like, demanding it, basically.
Yeah. I think it's difficult, right? Because especially in the States, depending on where you are, if there's less funding for public transport, you kind of have to have a car because it's hard to get anywhere without
sure.
it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, if you have a car and then you move into a situation where it's like almost exclusively public transportation, then it's just like, well, now I'm inconvenienced because there's nowhere to put my car. So it's like
yeah.
this weird duality of needing either a good mixture of both, like you have to have the proper infrastructure for public transportation, but you also have to be conscious of the fact that a lot of people have cars.
Right. Like,
it just isn't built to support both at the same time, and it's hardly built to support whatever it currently has. Also.
Well, and it also comes back to the culture.
Yeah.
Right? Like, as yeah. Americans now, we are three generations into this car thing,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even four, depending on how you count it. But like it's so ingrained in our culture, right?
It is.
So, and like we talked about a little bit earlier about like how it's not necessarily just like what's available, but it's also about like the culture of public transportation that plays a huge role in like who uses it and like what it's, you know, because like I've definitely been in situations where, you know, like in New York or big cities where everyone takes public transportation, you know, I'm like, great, let's do it. But then there are other places that I've been to, you know, that are may or may not be so populated, but they have public transportation, but I would probably be less likely to take it because A, it doesn't look well funded. B, it's not on time. And like C, you know, there's not enough cars on the road where it makes me fear for my life.
Well, that too. Yeah. And the opposite too. I know there's some people that don't use public subways and things. I mean, I see it on TikTok all the time when they make fun of being on like a New York subway train and you see like all the weird crap that happens like it's on a subway. And as a female, that can be a little unnerving sometimes, you know, just, oh, what am I going to encounter today? Like, who am I going to have to deal with today, you know? But, you know, I think that's where things like funding come in and could maybe support, you know, better movements to make it more functional, on time being one of them, making it safer, making it more enjoyable. Because I know for 1000% fact that even places like Japan, I literally watched a video where they maintenance them so well, they're so clean, everyone's so respectful of, you know, the space. Right. That's also a culture thing. And so if you ingrain that in the culture, then you have opportunities like that for other things. You can have your car, but you can eat your cake too. You can take the subway and feel safe and comfortable if it's ingrained into the culture.
Yeah. Like public spaces are also our spaces.
Correct. Spaces. Right. Yeah. They're shared spaces, but it's my space. So you have to respect it, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've ridden the London Underground, which... And I've done, you know, the subways in Paris and Germany, and they're all just like so lovely. And I know that people who live there probably don't think that.
They may not share the same sentiment,
But if you've ridden the New York subway, you know that all those subways are better.
My God. If
for a variety of reasons.
If you've ridden a Maryland Metro... it's disgusting. It's gross. It's just gross. If nothing else, safety aside, it's just gross. They're just not well taken care of, and there's tons of derailments. There's tons of, and that makes you late, and then the next metro's late, and now you're late for work, and you have to take a taxi, or you have to take an Uber, or you have to figure it out. Like, and to your point, it just makes it less inviting, and then you're like, well, I'll just get a car. Like, I'll just get a beater and like just take my chances, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, well, I agree. I think it needs to be, we need a better mixture than what we have.
And also the fact that a lot of other countries have high speed rail.
Yeah.
We are just on the cusp of like introducing it is outrageous.
It's a little behind, but again, it's all been, you know, priority of funding and like priority of support from, you know, the government or, you know, other subsidies that help support that. This has been like a pull of focus, but you know, it's okay.
I know.
Take your time, I guess. It's taking you this long.
I mean... I have more words, but it's fine.
But also, I'm trying to think too, though, like if America had more reliable transportation that was public, accessible, that was maybe integrated well, so then it also wasn't expensive. You know, because train travel, if you take an Amtrak, it's not nearly as expensive as a plane, but it's going to take you twice as long to get there. So if you have something that is efficient, inexpensive, and accommodating, then in my opinion, you have people who are more mobile and more free, similar to a car, but now they're also traveling and funding all these different spots because they're using their time and money to visit places they previously could not go to
Boosting the economy.
Mm-hmm. the economy. And also, you know, we have less cars on the road. You have to worry less about the crazy airports because now everybody's just zooming in the tracks, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you have less congestion there. It starts to take away a lot of the stress that comes with that current transportation avenue. Like, yep. there's lots of things that could improve with that and also help boost the economy after the expenses have been paid.
So, not to mention, like, the expense of creating a high-speed rail create mm-hmm. jobs, which is another good thing the economy.
Absolutely.
And then we wouldn't need Taylor Swift to come to do a tour and boost all of the economy of the entire country. Like, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Not only that, but outside of the building, now you have permanent jobs of running it as well and engineering right. it and maintaining it. And now mm-hmm. each stop that it takes in between now is also manned and boosting. You now, instead of having service stations for your car, you have train stops. You know what I mean? Like, yep. it's just like that in yep. between. So, I could definitely see the benefit of that. Just not even from like a personal, I can go places, but an economic, you know, situation yeah. as well, that would be really boosted. So
I don't think there's any downsides. I think we're kind of slow on the uptake, and I'm a little disappointed at us for that.
Hopefully we get there in the end. I would love to, yeah. you know, it would be super fun to experience in this lifetime if they were able
yeah.
to do it. You know?
Oh my gosh. And like, what if the high speed rail mm-hmm. from East Coast to West Coast mm-hmm. and it would take you like, I don't know, 6 hours?
Yeah. And even if it took longer, I mean, they have trains that have sleeper trains, like yeah. sleeper cars. I've never yeah. done that, but it sounds like so much fun.
It does sound like fun. And there's only like one or two trains that do it. And it's yeah. kind of expensive right now.
Very expensive.
You know?
Yeah. And again, it takes you twice as long to get yep. where you're going.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, I think that's super fantastic. I hope, listener, that you also felt it was super fantastic. And also, even if you're from the United States, we'd love to hear your point of view on this. Like, what do you think? Mm-hmm. Would it be a boost? You know, are you living in a place where you'd want it?
Yeah. You know? Also, if you live outside of the United States yeah. and you've experienced these things, tell us if we're overhyping it, because maybe... I don't know. What is your take?
Yeah, it's true.
If you love it, tell us you love it. If you hate it, tell us why.
You know, it's like that thing where you always want what you can't have. And then it's
right.
just like whatever.
Grass is always greener. That
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah. I can't think of a bad reason, but I'm sure there's things that you would have to consider, of course, like infrastructure and like where sure. it goes. But all of that aside, we also would love to hear your opinions as always. Of course, you can send us comments, questions, or concerns, or episode topics to our Gmail, mediocrecontentpodcast@gmail.com. You can also connect with us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at the same handle. If you leave us a comment, we do check it as often as possible, and we'd love to be able to respond to you and or include you in Mediocre Mail in any future episodes that we might have. And of course, you can connect with us live on Twitch every other Thursday, and that's same exact handle as everything else because we make it as easy as possible. And you just pick the time zone you're in. 3 p.m. PST, 6 p.m. EST, 11 p.m. BST. And if I haven't covered one, you just look it up on ye old Google to find it. And all, you know, as always, give us 5 stars, 1 star, 3 stars. Any stars that you're willing to throw out, we will be absolutely willing to take. And I guess we'll see you guys next week.
Yes, we will. See you next Tuesday. This has been Mediocre Content.
Thanks so much for listening. Cheers!
Cheers!